Is it stupid to pray about things that you've done to yourself that are causing you grief? Like, what do you think? I hope it's not, you know, because it's a lot. Most of my prayers fall in that category. I lost my phone, so if you think of it, you can pray about that. There you go. Last summer, not this past summer, the summer before, we went as a family out to Bernie and Judy's cottage for the day, which was lovely to have time with them. Tyrion, who was then 10, and one of those kids who would just kind of take on anything, kind of looked around at the lake and at all the boats that were moored and hinted that this might be the perfect occasion for him to learn how to water ski. And as it turned out, it was. And Bernie was just like ready to jump in the lake and make it happen. You know, I mean, you can imagine that, right? And so that's what we did. We got him geared up. And I mean, he has the occasion of having parents who, one of whom taught water skiing for a decade, and the other one of whom learned how to ski as an adult. I would have been the one who learned how to ski as an adult. And so there's people in the boat, you know, that know him and love him and know what this is like to learn and are cheering for him. But we weren't going to teach him because Bernie was ready to go. And his boat, his space, his enthusiasm, we were just cheering, right? But we kind of knew what it was like to go through this. And so Tyrion gets all geared up and Bernie's in the lake with them and they're floating around. And Bernie tells Tyrion the same thing that every water ski instructor I've ever heard teach tells every kid that's in the lake the first time. There's this set of things that you kind of just have to do to make this work. And they're pretty simple when you sand. Keep the skis parallel in front of you. Tips up, don't bury them. Your knees bent, your elbows straight, and let the boat pull you up. There. Do that. Something good's going to happen, right? So that's the gist of it. So the thing is, though, when you're learning how to ski, how many of you have had this experience in a way that you remember? A few people, okay. So you're floating, you're in the lake, so you're already kind of in an alien environment. You've got things strapped to your feet that are way too big to do anything coordinated with. That's how it feels when you're not moving on them, right? You're just kind of in the way, and they float, right? So they're kind of doing this. And you have a life jacket on, but you don't float, really, not like they do. So the skis are trying to upend you. They want to go like this, not like that. And you just feel like an absolute klutz of just an alien being in an alien environment, and it's not pleasant at all. And then this person who's behind you, and these people in the boat are telling you to do these things as though they were the most natural things in the world, right? This just the obvious things to do, and everybody seems to agree these are the things to do, but everything inside of you is going, ah, no, 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 I need to grab something and pull myself to the surface of the lake, because if I don't, I'm going to die, right? So all the instincts that have to do with humanity and water are running counter to all these things that the people are saying to you are the things to do if you want to get up on skis. It's just completely against every intuitive bit inside of most of us. But here's the thing. I mean, you could argue that we're not made to be under the water, in which case maybe you could argue that we're not made to learn how to water ski, but either way, what we want to do is we want to get on top of it. And everything in us says, I need to bring all my resources to bear to getting on top of it. But what the instructor keeps saying is, let the boat pull you up. And of course, if you think about that direction from the vantage point of the beginner skier, it's like listening to somebody say, I know you want to go forward, but what you need to do is lean back. I know you want to get up to the surface, but what you need to do is sit down into the lake. Like, it's just, right? Runs completely contrary. It's one of those funny things, though, where if you don't do the thing that you're being told to do, which is the essential thing, if you do what your intuition says to do, which is pull yourself up instead of letting the boat pull you up, one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to get yanked forward out of your skis, in which case you're going to get sinus blast, or you're going to kind of get up and then you're going to fall backwards off your skis, in which case you're going to get another kind of blast. And either way, it's an unpleasant experience, right? Some of you have been there, and I can tell. It turns out that, counterintuitive or not, how bad was it, Kim? That's okay, we're good. We're good at that. So it turns out that the counterintuitive thing to do is the only thing that actually gets you what you're there to get. It gets you what you want. You actually do have to let the boat pull you up. And then it works. And as it turns out as well, the story that Jesus had to tell had at the heart of it something that I'm just going to call, for this conversation, I'm going to call it gospel. I'm not going to call it the gospel. I'm going to call it gospel as a proper noun, the name of a person, place, or thing. At something unto itself at the heart of this story. And the reason I took all that time with the water skiing story is because gospel is a bit like let the boat pull you up, in the sense that at its heart, it's counterintuitive. It is a story that strikes us as unexpected and strange and even foreign or alien. It just seems wrong. It runs counter to the way most of us believe that the world works, and it runs counter to the way that most of us have experiences that tell us this story told this way is not going to work. One of the first real kind of teachings that comes out when Jesus goes public is that he announces God's blessing on those that he calls the poor in spirit. And I don't know about you, but I have heard that phrase used lots of different ways. I've heard it defined lots of different ways. One of the ways I like the least is when poor in spirit is used to describe people who don't have the Spirit of God. It's sort of as though the Spirit of God were a commodity that you could get. And so to be poor in spirit is to not have what I have, in some religious sense. I don't think that's at all what Jesus is talking about. I think he's simply talking about those who are lacking. He's talking about those who don't have it all sorted, who don't measure up, and who know that they don't measure up. He's talking about the losers. He's talking about, in his context, the physically lame. He's talking about, in every context, the washed up and the wiped out and the not good enough and the good people who made a mistake, and the, you know, you can keep the list going, right? And the word that he uses when he says that the blessing of God is for these people, the word that we translate blessing, that's a pretty rich, evocative, nuanced word. It's got a lot more to it than we usually give it credit for. But if we were going to try to distill it a little bit, the simplest way that also encompasses enough of the meaning, if you will, might be to say that the word blessing means God is on your side. I had to go through a bit of an edit in my wallet the other day because it was just kind of getting out of control. And I have this kind of this big travel wallet that I really like because you can keep track of a lot of things in it. And as I confessed about losing my phone, I need some help with keeping track of things. So I have all these cards in there. But the top card slot, which is kind of where I put the cards that I use at least but that I still need access to, had, I don't know, 8, 10, I don't know, a big wad of cards in there. And it kind of stretched the pocket out. And it was getting so every time I opened my wallet, all these cards would kind of come spilling out, which if you want to disarm people so you can meet them is really great. But if you don't feel like cleaning up embarrassingly after yourself in public spaces all the time, it's not so great. So I thought, you know, I should deal with this. I should just go through these because I can't possibly need this many cards right at hand all the time. There's just no way. So I started going through them. And what I discovered is that over half the cards in my wallet are one version or another of a points card. You know how this works, right? Every time you buy something, you present that particular institution's card or the Air Miles card or whatever, and you get points. And if you get enough points, you trade them in for something that you want or that you need. Well, the place where this works is at Superstore. You know, I mean, I'm not even going to tell you what our grocery bill is, but I can tell you that when the lady says, "Would you like me to check your points?" I say, "Yes," before she's even done that, you know, even done the question. I remember to use that one, and I remember to retrieve those points. Then I got a whole bunch of cards in there for, I don't know, some CD store that went out of business like 20 years ago in Winnipeg. It's got one stamp on it. It's not working, right? But that's the way the whole system works. So I just kind of took most of those and put them, you know, somewhere where they wouldn't fall out all the time. And it made an enormous difference in my life. And that's my whole sermon. So have some coffee. Thank you. Thank you, brother. And now, I have lots of conversations with people, and I feel like I've spent way too much of my own spiritual life living in a space where I seem to think that God kind of works like my Sobeys card, or like my PC credit card, you know? Like, every time I do the right thing, I get some points. And if I get enough points, I'm going to get the thing I want. What's the thing I want? Well, you can describe that lots of different ways, but one of the ways it's been described in the history of Western Christianity is a free pass to heaven, right? I get to take a pass on hell and go right to a place where everything that's busted here is not busted. But I got to have the points to get in. If I don't have the points, I'm not in. An interesting thing is a lot of what, and that understanding of what it means to be embraced, received, affirmed, welcomed, loved by God. In that kind of a way of thinking about this whole idea, the things that get me points are mostly things that are about doing good, right? They're mostly about being more moral. They're maybe about meeting some particular religious codes of behavior, perhaps being more diligent with this curious word form that we've changed from noun to verb, doing my devotions. You know, whatever it is, giving somebody some change on the street corner. I mean, I could keep going down the list, and most of the things on the list would be arguably good things. They would be things that are good in the sense that they would help me live as a kinder, better human. And that's not something to just toss aside. That stuff's important. The thing is that if I'm operating on this sense that God works like my Sobeys card, I'm still doing all those things so that I can get enough points so I can be in, so I can be accepted or validated or whatever my picture of being in with God is. And really, given how many systems like that we're surrounded with in the world, it kind of feels like a common sense way to approach God, right? I mean, we know how it works. Do the thing, present the card, get it stamped, get enough stamps, get the reward. And so we're surrounded by an environment that trains us to think about getting what we want or need like that. And so it kind of makes sense to us that we would come to God like that. Problem is that perking away underneath that system of thought is this way of believing that says I'm gathering points and until I get enough, I'm out. And once I get enough, I'm in. And then we're done. Because that's how the system works. But the thing that I am referring to by the proper noun gospel this morning doesn't actually work that way. The thing called gospel is such a radical kind of good news that it flies in the face of common sense. If common sense says that we should pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps in order to know the favor, the blessing, the experience of God being on our side, if common sense says that that's the way the thing works, and if our other experiences in the world suggest that that's the way the thing works, the thing called gospel says that's not the way the thing works. The thing called gospel is the kind of good news that says that it is precisely at the moments of our greatest despair, our greatest failure, our most profound weakness, when we're losing full on, when we're frustrated, when we're deep, when we're living out something that we know is broken, something that we know is, we could use the word sin for, when we feel helpless, when we're wandering around lost. Those are exactly the sorts of moments where the thing called gospel, the thing that Jesus is talking about when he talks about the blessing of God, arrives, is present. This is the way the story goes. And it counter to almost everything that we believe is true about the way that the world works. It's one of these moments where in those kind of places that I just described, places of despair and failure and weakness and losing and frustration and lostness, it's in those kind of places that the thing called gospel would have us understand that God comes to us and says to us, right there, in that place, hey, you, underdog, I'm on your side.
And that's counterintuitive. I want us to reconsider our idea of the place of the underdog in the universe a little bit. Author that I enjoy, because he's a really intriguing thinker and a very funny looking person as well. It's not easy face to remember. Hey, isn't that a great smile? This is an awesome smile. Anyways, Malcolm Gladwell. Gladwell, best known for some mega sellers that have kind of stood common sense on its ear in other ways. Books like The Tipping Point, and Outliers, and Blink, all worth a read. He's got a new book out called David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. Interesting book from the excerpts I've read of it. I haven't read the whole thing. I want to read you a little bit of an interview that he gave about a month ago about some of the ideas in that book. The interviewer says, David and Goliath is a very enjoyable book, partly because of our deep-seated instinct to cheer for the underdog. Why do we do that? Gladwell says, because it makes the world seem more just. This is not the point that I want to draw from this. I just want you to notice that he's not half a dozen words into an interview about taking on, among other things, corporate giants by being a non-incorporated underdog. And he's already using the language of the moral universe. It's just fascinating. Anyway, why do we cheer for the underdogs? Because it makes the world seem more just, or at least, it makes the world seem more hopeful. Okay, now we're a dozen words in. Makes the world seem more hopeful, because if the favorite always won, then there's no point, right? There'd be no point in fighting. We're instinctively thinking of future situations where we will be outmanned, and we want to make sure we still have some kind of chance. The interviewer asks him, whom we see as the underdog, though, isn't always the underdog. Take the David and Goliath story. David has the distance weapon, a slingshot. So in what way is the lumbering Goliath the favorite? And this is Gladwell's answer. He says, we do sort of stack the deck. One of the points I wanted to make in the book was that our kind of instinctive idea, our intuition, to use the language we've been using this morning, our instinctive ideas about what is an advantage and what isn't are often wrong. With David and Goliath, what guided our understanding was our sense that being big and tall and strong and well-armed was always more advantageous than being audacious, fast-moving, and lightly armed. But in fact, there's no reason why. Big and strong and well-armed is not always best. That's just our default position, and it's an erroneous one. That's just our default position, and it's an erroneous one. So, if I'm suggesting that gospel is, among other things, a story that cheers for the underdog, I am, to put it into that context, suggesting that gospel is a story that suggests that our default position when it comes to dealing with God, to being received and loved by God, is erroneous. It's wrong. And yet, the default position that being more polished up, more put together, more sorted out, more in control, sort of the equivalent of being something like a spiritual Goliath, the default position that that's what it takes to be loved by God, that that's the advantageous position when we come to God, just might be erroneous. It just might be completely wrong. Did ever strike you as interesting how careful we are to get ourselves kind of sorted out when we present ourselves in the presence of others that also make claim by the space that they share to be seekers of God? Ever notice this? I think we're learning some good things about this as a community, and I get really excited about that. I listen to us sort of take the risk of sharing some of the true things about our lives in this space. And I know what happens outside of this space too. And that's appropriate and good. But have you noticed how hard it is to do that?
We just kind of, we really kind of like to show up in a God-seeking space and just be sorted. Just be Goliath. Be from in a position of strength, you know? I had a really rough week, but I'm doing awesome today. Thank you, Jesus. How lovely.
Not a thing to disdain. Unless, of course, it's just a default position. In which case, it's still not something to disdain, but it is something to consider. How come, do you think, when we come to church, we have this tendency to act like the way that the whole thing works is that this place, this religion, where we need to either, is a place where we either need to get it all sorted out or be all sorted out to be accepted, to be in with God. I know there's a danger in this idea. Having said that, I can't help but wonder if some of the answer to that question is that we've been taught to think that. The danger, of course, is that we can now hand this off to the teachers and not be responsible for our own actions and choices, right? But it's also a thing to take into account. And maybe, just maybe, we have been taught an erroneous default position about what it means to come to God in a way that is just absolutely massive in scale. That's just enormous and almost... It has a kind of cultural weight where if you stand in front of it, it's like that picture of that protester standing in front of the tank in Tiananmen Square, right? You sort of feel like, I'm glad you believe in what you're doing because you're going to die. I hope you're ready for that because you just stepped in front of the cannon, literally. There's so much weight to this other position. For those of you, this is part of how that strikes me. This past Thursday, in case you missed it, was Halloween. And Halloween, we have two recorders running this morning because we're experimenting. So, Halloween is one of my favorite cultural events. It's just true. I like Halloween. And now, I get that there's, you know, another side to this story too. But honestly, the bent darkness of Halloween kind of has about as much traction as the shiny fuzziness of Christmas at this point in the culture. Like, the things that bentness is based on historically don't exist in the culture anymore. And so it's kind of a sham. But here's why I like it. I like it. Because, like no other time of the year that I'm aware of in our culture, this is deeply ironic to me, and delightfully ironic to me, this holiday, this little event that's supposed to be based on fear, is the time in our culture when, like no other time that I'm aware of, a whole bunch of people open their doors to a whole bunch of strangers on the same night and say, come on in and have a treat. What the? Right? Like, come on. Is that not awesome? So we celebrate Halloween. Now, we celebrate it in a way that feels really communal to us, that I hope touches on the best of this for us as a family. So we have some friends in the city. We live in the country. I mean, if we were going to go trick-or-treating, it would cost us $60 in gas and we'd get 3 chocolate bars. It just would be stupid in terms of return on investment, you know. So we come into the city. We have some friends who live in a more of a densely populated neighborhood with lots of young families. We bring our kids that are still going trick-or-treating. Davis and Kale have opted out at this point. Actually, Kale got dressed up in some absolutely gory costume and went to a party of his own. Another story for another day. But the little guys got dressed up. Their buddies are about the same age. We go to our friend's house. We have a meal together with them. We go out in the neighborhood, and we go trick-or-treating in the neighborhood. And we come home, and the adults drink tea, and the kids set up shop and trade for the candy they really want, right? It was hilarious. We walked in, and Anna, one of Taya's little buddies, we walk in, and she's got the piano bench open, and the lid's flipped up, and I'm like, what are you doing, Anna? She's like, I'm setting up my store. She's got all her candy, but she knows what she wants and what she's going to trade, right? So the barter system was alive and well. Anyways, so that's kind of the pattern. Now, the other thing, we've done this for a number of years, and the thing that happens, part of it, is that a couple doors down, there's a family that have become friends of our friends, neighborhood friends. They have a daughter about Taya and our daughter, and their daughter, Anna's age. And so this daughter and one of her parents has been coming along on these little tours, you know, at Halloween. So last year, Jen came with her daughter. And Jen and I think I've probably told you about this conversation some other time, but Jen and I had this fantastic conversation while we were following the kids around the neighborhood. Just, it took like 2 houses, and we were into spiritual terrain, and we just had this fantastic conversation the whole way, and she's become a friend. And this year, as we were just getting ready to go out, Christy showed up at the door instead of Jen, the other half of the family, of the parents, and with their daughter. And she said, I won the coin toss. I get to go on the walk and talk this year. So, okay. So, you know, she wasn't being ambiguous at all about what she came for. She wanted to go for a walk and have a real conversation while the kids were doing what they did. And she just announced it right when she came in the door, which I just thought was fantastic. So we get out there and we start talking with one another. And it turns out that Christy is, among other things, working on her certification to be an art therapist, which is very interesting stuff. And that her and Jen, as a couple, and that their family together, are deeply aware of the realm that we would call the realm of spirit, of the spiritual. They're very attenuated to that reality in the world, and deliberate about seeking it out. And not just seeking it out, but bringing it into their work, which is, as you know, if you've ever had an experience like the one Jason described, wherever you went, sitting around a table or sitting in a classroom where spiritual comes into it, this is tricky terrain, right? So Christy works now, while she's studying, she works with survivors of traumatic abuse. And she was very circumspect in how she described her work to me, but you didn't have to be really firing on all your cylinders to read between the lines to know that lots of the people that she works with are survivors of the residential school program. And one of the things that she does with the people she works with is she helps people learn and practice what she calls mindfulness. And mindfulness is the idea that, very simply stated, we need to be still and listen for the ancient wisdom that we all carry within us, and then we need to act on that wisdom, what comes to us when we are mindful. She described it to me as a Buddhist idea, which it recognizably is historically, and that led us into a conversation about the linkage between the Buddhist shape of the idea of mindfulness and the historic Christian meditative tradition or monastic tradition's shape of that same idea of mindfulness. And the presence of wisdom beyond time in our humanness. There are things that we bear that we didn't ask to bear, that we just have because of who we are. And so we just had this, I don't know who I get next year who gets to have that. I'm looking forward to Halloween already. Like, if it's going to always be like this. For me, I mean, the kids had pillowcases full of what they came for, but I just was filled up. It was just so lovely. And I also came away from that conversation, as I often do in times like this, really, really unhappy about this particular segment of Christendom's legacy in Canadian history, this collusion of church and state that produced institutional abuse. It's easy to be judgmental from a distance. It's easy to be unhappy and angry and all of that. It does not very fruitful, probably, in the end. It's a thing to be careful about for sure. But part of what made me so unhappy was that this idea of getting sorted so we can be accepted by God, of getting it together by some standard that is measured primarily culturally, morally, linguistically, religiously, it's measured by a system that we've constructed to manage and measure value in the world and to manage and measure our encounters with a divine being, with God, that way of thinking and acting in this instance, in our own history, in this country, steamrolled an entire culture, complete with its spirituality, which, by the way, is redolent with the thing we would now call mindfulness. When I feel resonance between religions as a Christian, I rarely feel it more strongly than I do with, in particular, the creed. Like, there's just so much at play in this thing that we wiped out that is about the integral, honest seeking of a divine being, and that divine being directing the way we live. And that's the thing, among other things, that we wiped out in the name of what? In the name of a points system. In the name of a cultural framework that if you just would behave right in it, and speak right in it, and be right in it culturally, guess what? You're in. You see what I'm saying? When you describe it that way, and I know I'm just describing it from one vantage point, I get that. When you describe it that way, it's so easy to see how it's broken. But there were a bunch of people in that system operating it, not because they went home and went, how can we be malevolent? How can we do as much harm as possible? But because the system had so much weight, so much momentum, so much impetus, that there were good people who believed this is the way to God. But when we look at the first words almost out of Jesus' mouth when he's describing the thing called gospel, he says, guess what? This story's not for the people who are in the system. It's for the people who don't fit.
It's for the people who are broken, for the people who can't make it work. Those are the people to whom God says, through me, Jesus is saying, right out of the chute, I'm on your side. And yet, when we come to church, when we're with other people with whom we understand we have a shared faith, or when we're in the world in general, we don't see the connection between our intuition to have it all together to call ourselves beloved by God or blessed by God and what I just described. But they are the same system. They're the same way of thinking. But what qualifies us for hearing God speak into our lives and into our world that God is on our side? And so we don't make the linkage between our own struggles with lying and our addictions and our anger and our wrestling matches with porn and our sense of helplessness or anxiety in the face of tragedy or change or just everyday life, our haunting sense that we can never be good enough for the people to whom being good enough matters deeply to us. And I could keep going. All of these things that percolate up in us this sense that suggests that we should never ever really reveal to one another who we really are. Because it lets us out and we want to be in. But maybe what it comes down to is our actually knowing deep down when we're honest with ourselves and we're in whatever place where we can be honest with ourselves that we do not have and we cannot be everything that we need on our own. But our intuition, our erroneous default position, is that the world works that way, so you have to do that if you want to get the reward. And maybe that default position is so deeply ingrained that it's hard for us to believe it when the first teaching out of Jesus' mouth is that God exists to bless the underdogs and that the underdogs are all of us who don't have it sorted out. It's hard to believe. Does it help at all, do you think, that when Jesus chose how he would live, he kind of kept acting this out? Does it help that he kept on touching the people that no one else would touch and being attentive to the cries of people who were being told to shut up because they were making so much inappropriate noise? And their confession was just out of line. Does it help that he kept on having dinner with crooks that were, culturally speaking, too big to fail, and after dinner going to the local watering hole so he could have a drink with a cheap trick from the wrong side of town? Does that help at all? And what happened? What happened when Jesus chose to challenge the conventional wisdom of the day? Which wisdom said, by the way, that God was only for some, not for everyone? And what happened when Jesus stood in solidarity with the poor? And what happened when he started to teach that God won't fit into just one kind of temple or one religious system? These are all things that Jesus said and lived. Well, among the other things that happened was that there was some serious pushback. And that most of the pushback came from those that were most deeply vested in the system working. I'm a religious professional. Every occupation has its hazards. One of my hazards is that I would want twice as many people in this room because I bet you I could make a case for my salary going up. Right? I mean, who's a success in the business of religion? And how do you measure it? That system can be just as broken as everything I've been talking about this morning. And when it's broken, yeah, I think there's a standard that system should be called to that makes those breaks more broken. I don't know how do you measure these things, but it's just wrong on wrong, you know? But I get what it's like to be both the person that wants to push into the erroneous default and say, no, we have to find a way to think and live differently than this. And I also know what it's like to be the person on the system side of it going, you know, if we just tweak this a couple of degrees, this thing could hum. And you know what the lever is that we're using to tweak it? The lever is, if you behave like X, you're in with God. Archimedes. If Archimedes had that lever,
He could have moved the world.
Now I know who had a classical education and who didn't. Right? There's pushback. This is not easy.
And there's lots of places we can go from this. I'm going to wrap this up. But what I want to do today is I want to simply suggest that knocking loose a long-held default position is never easy, and it is never cheap. It's hard. And it takes a long time, and it takes real effort, and it takes incremental effort.
The good news, if this has got any merit, the good news is that while we are making incremental effort, while we are wrestling with change, we are blessed. We're not wrestling with change so we can get it tidied up and then know the favor of God. It's actually the exact other way around. We're not working to change so we will be loved. We are loved, so we are working to change. It's the opposite order. If we actually take on a moral project in our lives, if we actually take on a behavioral challenge, if we actually have a go at a habit that keeps pulling us away from the sense of the experience of the welcome of God and the welcome of others and so on, of being in rightness in the world, if we take on those kind of projects, we take them on not so that God will love us. That's all dealt with. That's gospel. That's the story that Jesus came to tell and to live. That's settled out of the chute. And because that's settled, we can work. And we can work without being distressed about failure. We can work without being freaked out that we're not getting it right. I can be a pastor that listens to our community time and feels like, I know that there are stories we're not telling here, that it would be good if we did. That there's ways to tell some of the stories that aren't getting told here that I think that should happen. And I can know that in my heart, and I don't have to be distressed about it. I might wish for it, I may long for it, I may believe that it would be good, I may encourage it, I may try to practice it in my own limited ways myself. I'm going to work at it. But I'm not working at it so God will bless me. I'm not working at it, I'm not encouraging it in our community so God will bless our community. Because that is done. That's not the why. The why is because that would be a fit and deepening response, an engagement with love. And engagement with things is how we experience them. It's how we actually know them. We don't actually know this kind of stuff head first. We know it better in other ways. The difference between, as one writer I read recently, the difference between standing up a lab coat and watching people kiss and making notes about it and being kissed. Huh. Right? I think I'd rather have the kiss. And being able to knock these kind of default positions loose means being honest with ourselves about who we are and who we're not. And then letting that honesty start to form our beliefs and our choices and our actions. And it also takes being willing to receive love and care as grace-filled gifts and not as rewards that only come to those who have accumulated enough points by good behavior. It takes working our way into the understanding that not only is God for us underdogs, but in a bizarre and upside-down story, lived the life of an underdog himself and did so in a way that clearly says that the reward of blessing does not go to the strong, but it goes to the weak. The blessing, the acceptance, the embrace, the love, the care, the nurture of God doesn't go to the sorted out, it goes to the not sorted out. It goes to the not sorted out, I would contend, because that's who knows that they need it.